Hi, this is Alan Chartok. I'm delighted to be in conversation today with veteran and foreign correspondent Ann Simmons. Simmons has been named the 2018 James H. Ottaway Senior Visiting Professor of Journalism at New Paltz. Simmons currently serves as a global development writer-editor at the Los Angeles Times. She has produced extensive multimedia coverage of international issues ranging from hunger and poverty to gender inequality and human rights over a career in journalism spanning more than 25 years. She's worked stories including the fall of the Soviet Union, the war in Iraq, and Hurricane Katrina, and was part of a team of Los Angeles Times reporters whose coverage of the 2004 Southern California wildfires won a Pulitzer Prize for breaking news. Simmons currently serves as a global development writer-editor at the LA Times. Her most recent work has addressed subjects including the rise and fall of Robert Mugabe, the state of Barbuda nationals displaced after Hurricane Irma, and the high mortality rate of African-American women in pregnancy and childbirth. Simmons holds a double honors bachelor's degree in Russian and Norwegian from the University of East Anglia in Norwich, England, and a master's degree from Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. She was a Nieman Fellow at Harvard in 2003. Wow. We'll talk to Ann Simmons about all of this and all of her accomplishments and more. But first, I take a moment to welcome you, Professor Simmons.
Thank you so much, and not professor by any means. Yes, just a visiting professor.
Then it is our honorific title for you, and we are so glad that you're with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
So let's talk a little bit about your upbringing, where you were born, who your parents were, and all of that.
Okay, so let me begin. I was born and raised in southeast London, a small town called Catford in the suburbs of London. My parents are my father is now deceased. My mother is still alive. They were both immigrants from the tiny island of Grenada in the Caribbean.
Yeah.
And in fact, well, we all know Grenada as the small island that was invaded by President Reagan.
We invaded it.
Indeed. Unfortunately, we have that reputation.
And it has a terrific medical school.
It definitely does. And also great people, great food, or fantastic climate, just to give a plug to Grenada. I should add, though, that my parents are actually from a tiny island that is administered by Grenada. Grenada has two sister islands, one called Carriacou and the other called Petite Martinique. My parents are actually from Carriacou, and that is 30 miles northeast of the mainland, Grenada. And you have to take a small boat over there or a tiny plane. And the permanent population is only something like 6,000.
Really?
So they emigrated to England. Of course, these islands were former British colonies. So when my parents emigrated, they were actually British subjects at the time because the islands were colonized. And they emigrated, first of all, my father in the late 50s. He was engaged to my mother and then sent for my mother. And they were married in London in the late 1950s. And all of my family, all the children were born there, two older sisters and a younger brother.
Have you been back to Grenada?
Yes, indeed. I spend a lot of time in Grenada, absolutely. We still have extended family there, and we have some family land there and a home. So I spend quite a bit of time there. I try and get down there quite often.
And is your mom alive?
Yes, she is.
And she feels proud of her daughter?
Oh, she absolutely is. In fact, my mom still lives in the house where I was born and raised. So you can imagine when I go home to London, it really is going home because some of the old neighbours are still there and I return and they're like, oh my goodness, you know, little Anne is back and I'm no longer little Anne. But nevertheless, I suppose I always will be for them.
Yeah, that's where we get frozen in time.
That's right.
Sometimes that's good. And sometimes, as the case of the Chartok twins, it's not so good. So, okay. So moving on, how did you get to the point where you decided foreign correspondency was what you wanted to do?
You know, I decided that pretty early on. I always loved studying languages and I loved writing. And I knew, first of all, probably by age of 14 or so, that I wanted to go into journalism. I loved writing, but I also loved the sense of travel and meeting people and the sense of adventure. And that was one of the reasons when I started studying languages that I knew that that would come in handy. And it was a little bit of a fluke, really. I loved languages, but while I was in high school, secondary school, as we call it in the UK, I went to a regular public school. And if you didn't choose to study French when you were 11 years old, you were put in the Italian class, the German class, or the Russian class. Mm. And I got put into the Russian class and then developed this, you know, just this incredible knack for languages and this love for Russian literature and history and also the culture and just this mystery that was at the time the Soviet Union. Because, of course, it was the Cold War then and many people couldn't travel to Russia at the time, and everyone had this, you know, kind of these stereotypical images of Russians, and, you know, we were a kind of, you know, enemies, I suppose, in many ways, the West and the East. And so people were a little bit wary of Russia. But I always felt, my goodness, I'd love to get there. You know, what an adventure, what a mystery.
So how important is it for a reporter to be able to speak the language of the country that she's going to?
I think it's extremely important because I always say that I speak Russian. So that, yes, that's a big advantage when I'm reporting in the former Soviet Union, any of those former republics. But there are places that I've been to where I don't speak the language. And I think that it can be an incredible disadvantage because things can get lost in translation. And I always feel that even if you're able to speak a few words of a language, it goes a long way. It breaks the ice. Over the years, I mean, I'm studying Spanish now. I've studied Spanish. I've studied German. I've actually taken classes in Kiswahili and Zulu when I was based on the African continent.
So you pick it up real fast.
Yes, yes. I feel I do have an affinity and a passion for languages.
As opposed to me, who took Spanish for 130
really?
Years.
Oh.
Still can't get by when we visit somewhere.
And I'm still studying Spanish and struggling, would you believe it? And that's probably a much easier language than Russian.
Yeah. Well, Russian schmushen. However, Norwegian. Now, there is a language that many people describe as one of the hardest in the world.
You know, actually, it's not that. That's actually not the case. Yeah. Norwegian for an English speaker or a speaker of a Germanic-based language, which is what Norwegian is, can actually pick up the language quite quickly because it's got a very straightforward grammatical structure. And so if you're an English speaker, it's the accent, I think, and the pronunciation of words that make people feel, oh, my God, it's really difficult. But because of Norwegian, I can actually read Danish and understand some Swedish as well, because they're a family of languages.
We're talking to Anne Simmons, who is the Ottaway professor at New Paltz. But why Norwegian? Let's stay with that for a minute.
It's a good question. People always ask it. And I hate to sound cliche, but it was really about the literature and being able to read in the original, because so many of the subtle nuances of literature are lost in translation.
Sure.
And, you know, people think, oh, yeah, right. But it's very much the case. And I really loved the playwright Henrik Ibsen.
Yeah.
And I wanted to be able to read his works in the original.
Yeah, but he was so depressing.
Many people say that.
Are you the person who likes to be depressed in literature?
Not at all. It's kind of the style of writing, again. It was something that I was just drawn to for some reason. Who knows?
And you've read every Ibsen book?
No, I have not. I do not declare that at all. I think that it started as that. But at the time when I was studying languages and at university in England, as part of any language course, you had to actually go to the country to study the language,
oh,
which makes total sense.
Absolutely.
And as a result, I ended up going to the University of Oslo to study Norwegian for half a year, and then also to the Pushkin Institute in Moscow, because it was required as part of your course that you go to the country to study the language.
And when you were at the Pushkin Institute, was it the new Russia or the old Soviet?
It was very much the old Soviet Union. I hate to date myself, but this was way back in the early 1980s, in 1984.
Perfect, 1984. Yes.
At the time, you actually had to queue up, line up for the basics, like, you know, toilet paper and butter. And that's not just a rumor. That actually happened at the time. In the former Soviet Union, there were a lot of shortages. And so during that period, it was fascinating for me also because at the Pushkin Institute, there were students only from Western nations and other countries that weren't really on the road to socialism. There were no Russian students there. Mm-hmm. And most of the other students, there were Vietnamese students there. So they were actually communist at the time. But they didn't really want us mixing with Russians. So I remember my classmates and I, other students from British universities, would go out. We would go to the local banya, which is like a steam house. Mm. You could meet Russians there. We'd go to restaurants, because at the time, most restaurants, you had to sit at communal tables so you could meet and speak with Russians then. I met some fascinating people just going to the theatre, to plays and speaking to people. And, you know, they're always curious as to, you know, what are you doing here? What do you do? It was interesting also because many people automatically assumed that I was from one of the African nations that were on the road to socialism. I met several African students there from Angola, Ethiopia, all of these countries that were actually getting funding from the Soviet Union at the time. There were many students in Russia from those countries. And there was an institute just next door called Patrice Lumumba, next door to the Pushkin Institute. And many African students studied there, and you needed a special propusk, a pass, to get in there. And I would just waltz in because, of course, they all thought I was one of those students. I made a lot of friends there.
As a woman of color, when you're out in the Russian populace, were you unique?
You know, Russians from very much are always very curious. And even when I was last back in Russia, in Moscow, in 2014, and they stare a lot, number one, because I'm about 6'2", you know, tall and black, and of course they're going to stare. And there is a level of curiosity. Many people have said that Russians are not tolerant. That actually can be the case until they get to know you. They're very much about, once they get to know you, your friends for life. I know that Russians have been accused of being racist and xenophobic, and that exists. That exists in every culture, in my opinion. I think once you get to know a Russian, and if you have studied Russia and Russians, then that really goes a long way. That plays a role.
So, Anne Simmons, were you ever approached while you were there to be a spy for them?
You know, it's funny you should ask that because, you know, in retrospect, when I was a student there in 1984, I remember that my roommate and I, my roommate was British, also from the same university as I, and she was a year higher than I was. And we went out to Gorky Park in Moscow. Yeah. And we were actually skating on a skating rink because there's a lake there that freezes over. And I remember coming off to the side and two guys approached me and they were chatting. And at the time, I just thought they were being friendly. But now I've come to think of it, you know, they're wearing those, you know, trench coats and these shoes that we always knew that kind of Russian intelligence used to wear, a particular type of shoe. And they were chatting to me and asking me what I was going to be doing after I graduated. And had I ever thought about, you know, kind of branching out? And the type of questioning, in retrospect, I realise, I wonder if they were trying to recruit me.
Well, so you know, with any time I talk to anybody, I go wherever my very strange mind takes me.
Right.
And one of the things I was thinking of is we now have a president of the United States who said from day one that Putin was a good man, that the Russians were good, and still has never specifically said anything condemnatory of the Russians, except that lately, now that he's in all of his trouble, that, you know, the Russians did a bad thing when they dropped the canisters in Syria. So I'm fascinated. You're a distinguished international reporter. What do you make of all of that?
It's a really interesting question. I believe that Putin is extremely shrewd, extremely smart, extremely manipulative in many ways. I think that the president is being really cautious. I don't understand why right now. I really do believe that this is what's under investigation. Did he intentionally collude with the Russians? Maybe not. Maybe the Russians just found a good opportunity. They found someone who they could manipulate. Do the Russians have something on our president? Who knows? I think that's to come out. It's an interesting question because in many ways we often, and I think we kind of give Putin a lot of credit and maybe too much credit, which of course now he's just lapping up thinking, wow, they think I can do X, Y, and Z. everyone's afraid of me, I'm a powerful man. And we're giving him that credit. So I think absolutely the Russians are obviously, you know, involved in Syria. They are very much supporting the government of Assad. And they are responsible in many ways for the atrocities going on there. If they're arming the Syrians, if they are actually protecting the Syrians and also defending what the Syrian government is doing. And also on the ground, they have troops on the ground. They have launched airstrikes. So there is going to be, you know, justice has to be done at some stage. And they are responsible for those actions.
I would think so. We are talking to veteran foreign correspondent Anne Simmons, the Ottawa New Paltz Professor of 2018. How did you learn about being awarded this high honor?
How did I learn? Do you mean just
did they call you up and say, would you consider doing this?
Actually, I was kind of encouraged to apply for it. A very good friend of mine who actually also works at the university had encouraged me to apply for the...
At New Paltz. Okay, yeah.
Said that she thought that I'd be a terrific professor and could make a great contribution.
Right.
And so I thought about it and I applied and I had to have an interview, a panel interview.
On the phone, or do you have to come all the way?
Via Skype video, video. And, you know, the process took a while, and they decided that I was going to be awarded the position after the interviews, after going through the application and all of my material. And then they informed me by letter.
And what do you have to do?
At the university, yeah. I now have to do a series.
You know, I spent over 40 years at New Paltz. I love that institution.
Oh, it's a fantastic institute.
I do love it.
My goodness. And such a beautiful campus.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
You know, I'm looking forward. This is the beginning of my professorship. I'm very much looking forward to exploring and getting to know a lot of the students and faculty.
Yeah.
But I will have to do a series of lectures. I'm going to be doing three workshops in particular, one about women on the front lines. That's women covering conflict. I'm going to be talking about global development, so a workshop on global development and why it's important, and also a workshop on Russians and understanding Russia and Russians and how that has changed over the years.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
I'd like to be there. So I'm going to ask you a question. Women in the front lines, have you ever been in a situation, and I'm probably very naive to ask this, in which your life was in danger?
Yes, actually, on several occasions.
Can you tell us about some of those?
Well, one main one, I survived a suicide bombing in Baghdad in 2003. And how that came about, I was on temporary assignment there because it was the kind of the beginning of the war then. And the LA Times would send reporters. We had a bureau there with a couple of full-time staffers. But the LA Times would send in reporters on temporary assignments to help because there was so much news to be covered there. And I had recently returned to the United States from Johannesburg, where I had been based. And a couple of months later, I was sent and volunteered. It was not, you know, certainly not compelled to do these.
But were you aware it was dangerous?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I had covered several conflicts on the African continent before that and had also been embedded in the U.S. Army during the war in Bosnia earlier on in the 90s.
Mm.
So I'd volunteered to go over, and it was New Year's Eve 2003, and a group of us foreign correspondents who were there on the ground decided that we would go out to a restaurant for a meal on New Year's Eve. So we all went in convoy together with some of our Iraqi staffers. And to cut a very long story short, I was sitting in the back seat of a car with a colleague of mine in the front seat. We arrived in convoy, and as I was about to, I put my hand on the handle of the car door, and as I was about to get out, that's the last I remember, there was a huge explosion.
Really?
I must have been knocked out for a while because when I came to, I could hear is, you know, one of the drivers screaming, Anne, oh my God, where's Anne? And it turns out that a suicide bomber had driven his car into the entrance of the restaurant just as we had arrived. Several people were killed. I believe a dozen or so were killed.
Any of the people with you that day?
None of us that day. We were all injured, though.
Yeah, yeah.
A colleague of mine in the car in front actually lost his right eye. Chris Krull was the worst injured of the expatriate correspondents and had a broken arm. My other colleague in the front seat, Tracy Wilkinson, who was, I think at the time, Mexico bureau chief, also doing a rotation, had extensive injuries to her face and her hands. I had injuries to my face as well, glass embedded in my face. It took 2 years working with a dermatologist in LA to literally pick glass and shards out of my face.
Oh,
and thank God for good genes. I always tell my mom, you can't tell now that I've had any injuries, you know.
You cannot.
And so that thank God I was blessed. But it was, you know, it didn't even end there. When I was pulled out of my car, I was actually pulled out by some Iraqis. And I knew that because they were saying, oh, Sudanese, they were saying, because they thought I was a Sudanese national. I'm like, you know what, whatever, just get me out of here. We were thrown on the back of a pickup truck and ended up at an Iraqi hospital to begin with, where they tried to stitch up my head without anesthesia. I had several gashes.
Okay.
That didn't go well. We subsequently, one of our local staffers who heard the blast came running to the scene, commandeered an ambulance and took myself and my two expatriate colleagues to the Green Zone, which is where the US military had a hospital. And they patched us up. I was eventually evacuated by the British Royal Air Force because at the time I was a British national, a subject of Her Majesty, and I actually am a naturalised American now. I hold a dual citizenship. And so the British Royal Air Force actually took me home. And on that plane, there were several other so-called walking wounded British soldiers, and then several coffins covered with the Union Jack. Soldiers who had been killed in combat in Iraq and were being sent home.
Oh, boy. Okay, what else you got?
Right after that.
Any other dangers?
Actually, yes. Near escapes and many others in terms of I was covering a rally in the Democratic Republic of Congo,
yeah,
which is the former Zaire.
Yeah.
I was there with a colleague of mine who at the time was the bureau chief for Knight Ridder, Neely Tucker, who now works for the Washington Post. And we used to be travel buddies because he was based in Harare and I was based in Nairobi at the time. Harare, Zimbabwe. And we had gone to cover the situation in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The president at the time was Laurent Kabila, and he had taken over from the dictator Mobutu, who had pillaged the country. But Kabila had fallen out with his former allies, Rwanda and Uganda. So my colleague and I turned up at this rally. Our rule of thumb was never to stay more than like 10 minutes, assess the situation, make sure there are no crowds because you don't want to get stuck in a crowd. And Kabila that morning had declared that enemies of the state were Rwandans, Ugandans, and foreign journalists.
Wow.
Because he was really angry in particular at the French, who had been accused of arming some of his opponents. So my colleague turns up, my colleague at the time had a long white ponytail, could have passed as a Frenchman, you know, is what we always joked. And there was I looking like a Banyamulenge, which is the Congolese version of a Tutsi, and a hated ethnic group at the time, a group that was hated by Congolese. We turn up and we didn't want to get into a crowd, but a crowd suddenly formed and we thought we've got to get back to our car. And they started throwing stones and rocks and tried to trip us up and pushed us and hit us. And I took a couple of rocks to the head and we managed to get out of the situation alive, but terrified. And the next day, the US embassies were bombed in Nairobi and Tanzania. And we found ourselves scrambling, trying to get out of Congo to get back to Nairobi, Kenya, to cover that disaster.
And has Congo changed substantially since you were there?
Congo is now ruled by the son of Kabila, Joseph Kabila, yeah, and it's again in crisis. It's in dire need. It's a story, to be honest, that has been sorely neglected by the Western media. There are people dying. There are still a horrendous situation. The president in power at the moment does not want to leave, and it's way past time. It's one of those situations where he's overstayed, you know, kind of wants to lengthen his time in office. And there is suffering by ordinary people, and so many people have been killed there, and, you know, it's been ignored.
Well, you know, Anne Simmons, you raise a very interesting point. On the way in the morning, I leave the house at 3 in the morning,
yes,
and 4 sometimes, and I listen to the Beeb.
Right.
And the Beeb brings us up to date on what's happening in many of these countries.
Right.
You wouldn't really know it if you read the Western press.
Not at all. No, there's a very big difference, Alan, I've got to be honest, in terms of how, for example, the BBC covers news compared to maybe a lot of Western publications and cable news in the United States, where you would think the only story in the world now is what's going on with the Trump administration. And I will say that I still love the BBC. I mean, I'm probably a little bit biased having been born and raised in England, but I do want to know what's going on in Cape Verde or Indonesia or somewhere off the beaten track where, you know, that you never hear about it here unless there is some connection to the United States or U.S. national interest.
Okay, so as a foreign correspondent, and all I can think of is Humphrey Bogart in a trench coat.
Right.
As a foreign correspondent, you exist in this place called the L.A. Times. Have you worked in other places besides the L.A. Times or the news media?
Yes. In fact, I was based in Moscow for Time magazine.
Really?
And I worked for Time magazine for 7 years. After Moscow, I covered the State Department and foreign policy when Warren Christopher was Secretary of State for Time.
Yeah.
Yes. And did several, at the time, he did several peace shuttles to the Middle East. And I spent 7 years at Time magazine before joining the LA Times.
So what was it like? Did you get on the plane with Warren Christopher when
Yes, I was a member of the traveling press.
What was that like?
Yeah. You know, it wasn't my favorite type of journalism, to be honest. I'm a foot soldier. I like being on the ground. I like being able to interact with ordinary people and hear their stories, to touch and feel and sit in a village. You don't get to do that if you're covering the State Department or the White House. It's a different type of journalism. I always feel that it's kind of, you know, it's not manufactured journalism, but it's very much if the principal sneezes, you do get that in the press release. He sneezed today kind of thing, you know.
Do you try to get to be a friend with the principal? In other words, it accesses everything.
His people, absolutely. It's all about making contacts and sources and really getting people to know you and trust you as a journalist, which is so important, knowing that, yes, if you do tell me something in confidence, then it's in confidence. I'm not going to break that. So it's an important type of journalism, but it's very different to the type of journalism that you do if you are based in the field as a foreign correspondent.
Okay, so Time magazine then?
Before Time, I was actually at the Miami Herald.
Oh, were you?
And I was there for a couple of years straight out of journalism school. I did my master's at Columbia. And I got an internship at the Miami Herald to begin with just for 3 months. I remember telling my mum and dad, I'm coming home in 3 months. You know, I'm going to work for the BBC. Of course I'm coming back. And as life would have it.
They like you.
Yes, they offered me a full-time job. And I ended up spending a couple of years at the Herald before going to Time.
And what were you covering there at the Herald?
You know, I was actually based in the Miami Beach Bureau, which was fantastic.
Not
you know,
bad.
Here I am, born and raised as, you know, in Southeast London kind of thing, you know, to put my Cockney accent on, you know. And there I was on Miami Beach. Wow, this was fantastic. So I was covering 4 small municipalities, Bow Harbour, Bay Harbour, Surfside and North Bay Village.
Yeah.
And that's where I got my grounding in covering local news and local council meetings, the cops, very much a good grounding in basic journalism.
So why did you leave?
Because I really wanted to go to Moscow.
Oh, I see.
I really did. And that was my area of coverage.
And how did you do it?
Time magazine hired me.
I see.
And they hired me initially as a reporter researcher to work in their New York office. And I remember my colleagues at the Herald saying, oh, no, don't do that. You don't want to be a reporter research. But I knew that this was a way of getting in the door and also a stepping stone, because I think it was 6 months later, there was an opening in the Moscow bureau. And voila, here I am. I spoke Russian and
wow. Knew the place. And what do you tell your students now? What are you going to tell them about how to succeed? You know, is it that, you know, you've really got to take some chances and you got to put yourself out there and you got to beg your way in? And how do you do it?
I would say always be ready to take risks. And, you know, especially when you're young, you can make that mistake of going in the wrong direction because you've still got a chance to change that direction. Follow your passion, because there will be so many people who say, oh, no, it's not worth going into that. Forget journalism today. No, have a focus. And if you have a passion, follow that passion. You may find out that in the end, you know what, journalism actually isn't for me. But then you don't go through life thinking then that, my goodness, I wonder if journalism was for me.
So we have something called the dark side.
Right.
A lot of the journalists I know, you know, they go and they double their salaries by going to work as a PR person somewhere.
Yes.
Have you ever been tempted?
Well, you know, no, because I've always been passionate about journalism, but I understand that because you don't get into journalism for the pay. Let me put that out there, okay? Mm-hmm. You've got to really love being a journalist and wanting to tell stories and wanting to communicate with people, wanting to try to also make a difference through what you write or what you say on radio. There are people listening to you and reading your words and believing in what you put out there. So you've got a great responsibility, and you've got to get into this business if you feel that, you know, I've got integrity and, you know, and I'm honest and I want people to believe in that.
So tell me about the Los Angeles gig. There's been a certain amount of chaos out there, right?
You say chaos, we say just a little bit of instability. Yes.
So how has that all developed?
Yes, the LA Times has gone through a tumultuous kind of situation in recent years, and that's been well reported. I want to say first and foremost that I am still such a strong believer in the LA Times. We have an incredible group of journalists there that, despite the so-called chaos, put out a newspaper every day that's still solid, still go after stories like there's no tomorrow. It's impacted us because of the instability. We have a new incoming owner now, and we're all very excited about that because it's going to be local ownership. The LA Times also has just established a union for the first time in the newspaper's history.
Interesting.
And we feel that, you know, it's way past time. You know, now we have our representation. I feel that we have lost a lot of good people over the years because of retrenchment. And that's been the case, I think, across the board, the news industry in general.
Do you worry that they'll retrench you?
Yes, there's always a worry. Everyone's expendable. So yes, there is a possibility.
We have a program called The Media Project, and the head guy there is, I'm on it every week, but the head guy there is Rex Smith of the Times Union.
Yes.
Who shares your Columbia experience with you. And we duke it out, he and I, all the time, right, in terms of how much the way in which a story is written is really prejudicial in terms of where the reporter is coming from or where the editor is coming from. Do we put it on the front page or the back page or what? We have Donald Trump talking about the news media being fake news and manufactured news. Do you have concerns?
Yes, it's very difficult, actually, especially when, you know, the leader of the free world is saying that the press is fake and that, you know, don't believe this particular publication or that particular publication. It means that we have now this responsibility to double, triple our efforts in terms of making sure that we are accurate, making sure that our stories are properly sourced and that what we put out there is indeed correct, because any slight mistake gives, you know, anyone who doesn't believe in us the opportunity to say, see, I told you it was fake news. It's really difficult these days as well to be immune, if you wish. I mean, it seems as though every publication, every outlet has an agenda. That's what the public seems to think.
Well, Fox News certainly does,
I
think MSNBC does.
There are in cable.
I dare say, although I'll get hell for it, that I believe the New York Times does. I mean, I think that they have an orientation. I think it's a proper orientation, but they have an orientation.
I think that's why we, more than ever, we need to try and be objective. And I know people say, oh, yeah, right, objectivity
in
journalism.
Well, what is objectivity? I mean, as I've often said, he said, she said, and nothing else.
He said journalism.
But, you know, there has to be some ability to interpret. You know, the Washington Post says, here are 2,500, I think it's 2,500 lies that President Trump told last year. That's pretty specific.
I think there you're talking about then it's putting out facts that you know have definitely been verified and letting the reader or the viewer or the listener make up their minds. I still think we have that responsibility to put both sides out there, even though people call it he said, she said journalism, it's not up to us to decide what people think. We've got to present the facts, present people with information so that they can be well informed and make judgments. I don't think we're there to push. We shouldn't be there to just push an idea on someone. We should be there to educate, though, I think, in many ways. So, and I say that because there has been this push towards local journalism for many publications, including my own. And the argument is that people don't care about what's going on around the world. They care about what's happening on their doorstep. Well, I think it's up to us to let them know that they should care about certain things going on in other places in the world. That is up to us. Yes, of course, I understand the need to have local news coverage, and people, of course, want to know what's happening on their doorstep. But it's up to us as journalists to say, yes, that's important, but do you know what's happening in the Democratic Republic of Congo, yeah, or in Pakistan, or in Indonesia? That's because we live in a village today, right? The world is a village. We're all interconnected. You cannot be insulated from what's going on elsewhere.
We are talking to Ann Simmons, who is a veteran correspondent, as you have heard, very exciting, and is the Ottaway Professor for 2018, and she is a delight, and I can't tell you how happy we are to have you here.
Thank you.
So it has been said that Donald Trump has sucked all the air out of the news media, and he knows how to do it. He gets on, he tweets. The New York Times might write a comprehensive article, or the LA Times, about something. But in fact, he gets more attention because of, you know, 20 words than the fine journalists at these institutions. How is that countered? Yeah. Because you really got to give the people what they want, and they want to hear about this guy.
Yes, you do. We cannot not cover the president, and we cannot not cover what he tweets every day. But we've got to balance that. We've got to do that. But we've got to make sure that we're still going out there and doing the investigative stories, making sure that we say, yes, Donald Trump has tweeted X, but here's what you also need to know. Here's the counterweight, if you wish. So I don't think he has sucked the air out of journalism. I think it's, you know, we're still fighting back. We will not be silenced, because I think, you know, there was this push to kind of keep the press quiet. It's fake news. I think this has given journalism a kind of renewed energy.
Because, absolutely.
You know, people now are going out, and it's really like this competition journalism where everyone now wants to get to the finishing line. Everyone wants that scoop. Everyone wants to find those true facts. There is this renewed energy.
We have not seen this since Watergate, in my opinion.
No.
So my question is, you among all your other distinctions, you were a fellowship, a Nieman Fellow at Harvard.
Yes.
What did that involve? What did you have to do?
That's a terrific program. And they call it a kind of sabbatical for a year. Mm-hmm. And it's an opportunity to study whatever you want at Harvard. Take a year out and study whatever you want.
And what did you want?
I studied so many different things. There were so many things I thought I was behind on, including a lot of African-American literature. I also kept up my Russian. I took Spanish classes. I took German. I went to some Russian history and literature classes. There was just a variety. I kind of covered the board. I actually took classes from Henry Louis Gates as well, which was just a fantastic opportunity, lecture
classes.
What
was that like?
He is such an inspiration.
Yeah,
and
is.
Such a, you know, you could sit there and just, you know, mouth open thinking, my goodness, you know.
How many people were in that class?
That was a lecture class, and for younger students. So, you know, I was like an old fogey in that class, but it was a large lecture class. So, quite a few students in that
class.
So
what was the ambiance of Harvard?
People seem to think that there's this air of, you know, kind of self-importance. But I think in general, no. I think once you get into the community and find your way, I also had to, I didn't have to, but I volunteered to be kind of part of their global speakers program, where I'd go into classrooms, into schools, local schools, and talk about being a foreign correspondent, what it's like traveling, just to students, public school students. So that was great. We have to put on what we call a sound-in, which is a story of your life in pictures and words, which you present to your classmates so that they get to know who you really are, where you come from, what you're really about, aside from your title at your place of work.
Well, that's all so wonderful. You have seen the degradation that people can put themselves through politically. You covered countries where brutal dictators, you know, hold on to power and people don't rise up and say, we're taking back our power. What do you make of that kind of sense? Well, why don't those people just, you know, say the hell with you and bring out their pots and pans and take over government?
Yes, that, you know, we often think about that, but it's not that easy.
No, it isn't.
It's not that easy, especially when you've been maybe suppressed all of your life. And then you realize that, okay, yeah, that there is this, you know, through social media or from some other means, you realize that, you know, that there's got to be something better than this. Why have we put up with this? And what you're seeing now is a lot of, again, young people typically taking to the streets. Social media has certainly helped inspire a lot of these revolutions, in quotations. But there are, you know, it's tough just to say, okay, let's pick up arms and just get out there. That it's not as easy as it sounds.
So you covered Katrina. What did you learn?
You know, I think first and foremost, it was a shock that this had happened in the United States and the response had been really slow in terms of initially helping people. Of course, the help came later.
Quote, Brownie, you're doing a hell of a job.
Right.
By the President of the United States.
The images of people at the Superdome and the convention center begging for help, to me, was one of the most astounding things ever.
Really?
Having been a foreign correspondent, thinking, okay, this kind of thing happens in other countries. This doesn't happen here in the United States, the greatest, you know, country on earth. How could this possibly be happening? That was lesson number one. It was kind of, you know, it was on America unraveled and this view of America that I had never imagined. I, though, also learned that human beings are so resilient. And I kind of knew that from covering a lot of the conflicts on the African continent where people would just pick up and continue with their lives. They would have gone through such atrocities, but nevertheless, they wanted to live and they got on with it. I also found that with New Orleanians and people who had gone through the hurricane, there was this sense that, you know what, this is the new normal. Yes, there was a lot of depression and a lot of, I would say that when I was interviewing people, a lot of the time I felt like I was a psychologist because I would automatically build in 30 minutes for someone just to tell me what they went through. Whether or not the story was about that, I knew that people needed to talk. And it was, you know, I lost this and I don't have this anymore. And what am I going to do? And where is my life going? Which was fine. I would just be a listener because that's what that person needed before speaking to me about housing construction or, you know, insurance, or if the story wasn't particularly about, you know, what you lost. But I had to make sure to listen to that.
I have a son who lives in New Orleans. Yeah. And when I think of New Orleans, I think of food. And I'm wondering, as a foreign correspondent,
right,
is there a side of you that gets to enjoy the places you're at?
Let me say first and foremost, I am the worst guest ever when it comes to food. I'm the most finicky person, not good for being a foreign correspondent.
Well, what do you mean?
I don't eat meat or poultry. And I don't eat shellfish. And there are other things, you know, that I don't eat just because I don't like them or they upset my stomach. And I say that I laugh on the one hand, but on the other, it's quite serious because if you go into a home in the developing world and somewhere where meat is considered to be a luxury, this is like, my gosh, if I get a hunk of meat for my family, then, you know, I've arrived. This is fantastic. And there are you as a foreign correspondent saying, oh, no, don't eat meat. Sorry, you know, don't eat that.
Do you say that to people?
You know, I try and explain, but what I've always said is that I've always tried to travel with a good, you know, photojournalist who does eat meat and try to get them to eat my portion. Or I might say, can I wrap this up and take it away with me so I can eat it later? And then maybe give it to, you know, one of the staff at the hotel who may not have something to eat. There are always ways of getting around that.
So what do you eat? Carrots?
Right. I do eat regular fish to get my protein.
Regular fish, eggs.
And yes, indeed. And this is not a matter, I should say, put it out there. It's not a matter of morals being a vegetarian for me, actually. It is just a matter of taste. So I do eat regular fish.
So, but when you go to a place, a New Orleans or any of those places. Oh, you've just covered food.
Yes.
But they all have something special about them.
They do.
That may not have to do with the seriousness of your enterprise.
Right. I always try and find that what's below the surface in terms of, you know, the culture. Go out and listen to the music. In parts of Africa, I'd go, say, to a nightclub to see people relaxing in their own environments, even though they may not have enough to eat during the day. There's no reason why you can't dance at night. I think it's important to tell those types of stories as well, because despite the bombings, despite the war raging, life continues in these places. People still have children. They still get married. They try to go to school where possible. Life continues as normal, in quotations, normal. We wouldn't consider normal, but life continues. And I think that you've got to show that when you're reporting in order to get across that these are people just like we are. I think all too often in the West and in industrialized nation, if you wish, in developed countries, there is a tendency to look at those people in the developed world as, oh, they're poor, or they're used to not having a lot, or they're used to, so, you know, they're refugees, they're used to living rough. Well, actually, a lot of refugees are not used to living rough. And I give an example of, I was in, last year, I was in Jordan, or was it 2016? Losing track of time now. I was in Jordan covering the Syrian refugee crisis, and Jordan has taken in many Syrian refugees. And a lot of those refugees who are now scrambling to make a life in Jordan were considered middle class, upper middle class when they lived in Syria. They owned businesses, they owned their own car, they lived in nice housing. And now they were living as refugees in a tent camp, in a camp. And they're not used to that. No, they're used to the niceties that we're used to. And I don't think people always realise that. They just think, oh, well, they're poor, they're used to that. So I think it's important to tell stories that show people that people around the world in general, ordinary people, are so much, they're more the same than they are different.
Now, well, that brings me to, we only have a couple of minutes left, but I wanted to ask you this. It brings me to the idea that we now have emerging in lots of countries, including this one, a sort of nativist, get out of our country, this is our country, we don't want you here.
Yeah.
And it's a very appealing thing to some of the groups whom I consider despicable, but it happens, and it's it's real. Have you seen this firsthand?
Well, certainly we're much more insular, becoming much more insular here in the United States, right? With all the rhetoric about, you know, immigrants not being as popular or not as being as welcomed. But certainly in parts of Europe as well, there has been this kind of resurgence, if you wish, of kind of the nationalism and, you know, Britain for Britons, Germany for Germans,
Hungarians for Hungarians.
Absolutely. I mean, so certainly there is a level of that. I think it's dangerous simply because I believe diversity is so important. It enriches a nation. It doesn't take away from a nation if you have people from elsewhere. I understand, for example, in Hungary, I actually spoke to the Hungarian. His position at the time was foreign minister. He came into the LA Times. He was visiting Los Angeles. And I spoke to him about this. And one of the things was, he said, well, you know, we're not a Muslim nation. Muslims have a different culture to us. And maybe they would be better off being settled in Jordan, because Jordan's also Muslim, that the climate is the same as to what Syrians are used to. They don't really need to come to Hungary. And that, you know, there's an argument, you know, he could be right in many ways. Yes, they may be more used to living in the Middle East. But the fact is, these people are fleeing for a reason. There is oftentimes a well-founded fear of persecution. Most of the time what you feel is that, and what you know is that, people want a better life for their children. It boils down to their children. They want a place where they can live safely. And then you can argue, well, you know, why should we be responsible for them? Why should we take them in? I believe there is a responsibility to take in a certain number of refugees. I absolutely understand the argument that you can't take everyone, that you cannot accept everyone, and that there needs to be integration when people do arrive. I am very much a believer that, yes, if you come to the United States, yeah, it's great that you do learn English. I love languages. I'm a linguist. But I feel that if you are in a place, you should know the language, at least enough to get by. But that does not mean relinquishing your own culture or your own language or your own way of life. You can still keep that. People do within their own communities.
So what is the future of American journalism? We know, my friend Rex and others have said, 10 years from now, can't swear there are going to be anything on a piece of paper. You know, we know that journalism has gone in large part to the internet one way or another, but it can't make the same kind of money for the people who own the product as the others did. So what do you see as, are we in a real crisis?
I don't think we're in a crisis. Journalism is not dead. Journalism is evolving. And, you know, it's changing, but it's definitely not dead. And maybe we won't have a newspaper, a hard copy of a paper, but we will have something that's very similar online. And it still will be, you know, if it's got the same journalists who have integrity and can produce good stories, it will still be a solid product. Maybe it won't be a newspaper product. I think you remember, well, didn't everyone say that radio was dead when television came in? And of course radio's not dead. It evolves and you find different ways to tell stories. You find different ways to reach people. So I'm optimistic about the future of journalism because information is survival. We all need information. There's no way that there's going to be a time where you don't have an authoritative voice out there giving you what you need to know.
Yeah. Do you have to fight to get your stories in the paper?
No, not really. Not at this time. Because, in fact, even though I primarily cover global development, I am oftentimes asked to do national stories as well because we are short-staffed, so everyone pitches in where they can. I work on the foreign national desk. It is a combined desk now at the LA Times. Even though I'm really dedicated to foreign, I work on a combined desk. And there is always this need for stories to fill the paper, and everything runs online. So if a story doesn't make the paper, you know that it will get an audience on our website.
Or when I wake up in the middle of the night, you know, I never wait to see the Times the next day. I read the Times all night long.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff. Well, all I can say is good luck.
Thank you very much, Alex.
It is just so great. I've had such a good time with you today. You're what we call an easy interview.
Oh, thank you, Alan.
You really hold up your end so beautifully. We're out of time. We've been talking to veteran correspondent Ann Simmons, this year's James H. Ottaway Sr., visiting professor of journalism, and SUNY New Paltz professor. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Alan Chartok.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on WAMC's In Conversation with Alan series, or to order a physical copy, call 1-800-323-9262 or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or on the Google Play Store.